This season at the First Time Podcast, we are returning to our first time roots. We hear all the time from listeners who've gone from thinking about writing a book to starting to write a book to having their very own debut author experience.
One of the things that these new authors say is that they've gone back and listened to all the episodes that cover off the various milestones. So this year we're going back too. We want to capture that first time again ourselves. We're going to follow a first-time author across the year, catching up multiple times along the way.
Our very first follower first-timer is Megan Rogers, author of The Heart is a Star. This segment of Follower First-Timer is brought to you by HarperCollins.
Megan Rogers, last time we spoke, we met you. We found out about your writing journey, about your HER book, about winning the Policeman short story in grade five, and about your incredible literature teacher who took you up to the Melbourne Writers Festival. Now we want to hear a little bit more about this book, The Heart is a Star, which is coming out very soon. Can you give us, this is the scariest question we ever ask people and still the scariest question I ever get on a stage or on a, you know, panel. Can you give us the elevator pitch for The Heart is a Star?
Yes, I can, I think, she says nervously. Okay, so The Heart is a Star is a story about a woman who races to the west coast of Tasmania to try to stop her mother from killing herself. But in doing so, she ends up saving her own life.
Great log line.
Good pitch.
Okay.
All right.
And punchy too, right?
Like very punchy. When did that piece form? Because I know that writers go, oh my gosh, this idea of the pitch and what the book is about is so hard to get right. And often it doesn't come till a long time after you've finished the book and worked out what it's about. So when did that form in your mind? When did you work out what this book actually was?
So not very long ago. So a few months ago, I started to think about actually talking about the novel and what it's about, especially in short form. And I'd started writing a few sentences and a few paragraphs that I thought were okay. And then my father got really sick. And I saw him the day before he passed. And then he did pass away. And my sisters and my brother and I were doing that thing that you do when you organize a funeral, choosing many Bob Dylan songs and reminiscing. And I saw my niece, and she was standing, sorry.
No.
She was standing in the shoes that we had chosen to bury my father in. And seeing such a crystallized vision of life and death and being in the middle of it very quickly made me throw everything that I'd written about the book out, because it sounded pretty darn hollow, and it sounded try hard, and it sounded crafted. And of course, you know, what I gave you sounds a bit that way as well. But, you know, I was reminded in that moment about, I love Cheryl Strayed, and I really came to her when my father passed. I was completely unprepared for that grief, even though he had been unwell for a while, and I read a lot of her work because I love her humanity dearly.
Mm.
And it reminded me of a quote that she wrote about those times in our life when she calls it the obliterated place. And she said that those obliterated places are equal parts destruction and creation. They are pitch black and bright light. They are parched earth and water. They are the mud and the manna. And those words meant so much to me. And I realized that, you know, that is what the book is about. It's about life and death and the people caught in between, like I felt in that moment when I saw my niece walking around in my dead father's shoes.
I think she just made us cry again, Catherine. I think we're going to rename this follower first time section with Megan Rogers just the cry segment, maybe, and then we'll see.
In a good way, though, right?
In the best of ways. In the best of ways. Megan, it's extraordinary to think about your kind of reframing of the novel in terms of this extraordinary and huge kind of grieving moments in your life after it was written. So can you take us back to this idea we heard in the last episode about the anaesthetist that you met after this really intense period with your own daughter at the hospital, and the first line that you wrote? How did the character get up and walk off the page and begin to speak to you? When did the story really start to come into its own?
Oh, it's such an interesting question, and I think it is one of the hardest things that I've found to put my finger on. And I think often those moments of creativity when we're kind of in the zone, they're the magic that is so hard to encapsulate when you're talking about the writing process, isn't it? And so, as I spoke about in the previous podcast, you know, I went home and I wrote the first line, and Layla Burns did start to talk to me during that time. But, you know, I had two young children and I was finishing a PhD and all of the above. And so I would have to say that her story and the general plot of the book was put on ice for a little while because I was living life. I was, you know, making decisions that weren't about choosing to write. And it wasn't really until just before lockdown, and my two girls were finally both at school and I had a little bit more time, that I was able to think about Layla more deeply. And it wasn't really until both of my girls were at school and I was at home, and it did come back to my father again because he was in a nursing home at the time, and I'd gone to visit the nursing home. And there is a character in the book, Layla's aunt, who is the comic relief is not the right term, but she adds a little bit of brass to it. And I was sitting in the nursing home, and the humanity and of that, of all of those moments you see in a nursing home. And someone's daughter came in and they were visiting their mother, and they didn't have a very good relationship. And I could see and sense, and I think a lot of writers are empaths, you know, I'm always listening to conversations and to people, and I love people. I'm not an extrovert, but I love to know about them and learn about them and figure them out like a math problem. They're the kind of unknown in an equation for me. And I was listening to her talk, and she was talking to her mother, and she was quite angry. And then she came out and I could see down the hallway, and she pressed her back against the wall and she started sobbing. Mm-hmm. And that incongruity that many of us have felt, where, you know, whether it's a relationship with a parent or with a spouse or whoever it may be, a friend, with yourself, mm-hmm. you know, when you have such a complicated history and reality with people and yourself, I wanted to display that. And again, I went home and I wrote most of the plot line, because I'm a bit of a plotter, after I saw that woman crying in the hallway, because I wanted to carry that. Like, it, when you see someone and that vulnerability, she didn't know anyone was watching her. It's that stuff that catches in your chest and your throat. And she was so human and so real and so me and so you in that moment. And I wanted that. I just wanted to put that on the page.
You've talked a lot about the choices that we make to get the writing done, and also this incredible kind of time with young kids, PhD work, caring for parents that you were getting through. How do you make writing work in your day? What small logistical choices are you making to get the writing done?
Yeah, that's the ultimate question, isn't it? And I don't always succeed, and I haven't always succeeded. And I think, yeah, that's something that I really want to talk about during this journey, because, you know, I'm a mum of two small children. I work to pay the bills. I have realities. You know, it's not the Hemingway sitting in a study for days on end, or a person who has a partner at home who looks after everything for them. My reality is that I don't have those stretches of time, and that's okay. But the other reality is also it's really hard. Mm-hmm. And I don't want to pretend as if it isn't. I don't want to pretend like I have the solution, because I don't think I do. And I don't want to pretend, as joyous and exciting and as happy as this moment is, I don't want to pretend as if the lead up was that way. You know, the lead up was not full of joy and excitement and happiness. The lead up was full of really hard decisions. It was full of enormous amounts of self-doubt and, you know, on a daily basis, not knowing how I could choose writing. So to come back and answer that question properly and logistically, before I signed with my agent, back when I really had no, you know, people in my lives, you know, then in my lives, that's a Freudian slip. They're not writers, you know, and I don't have a big writing community around me. And so one of the things that I did was I did everything that it took. And part of that was, if I needed to myself tell people that I was going to the gym or I was going and doing something else which I felt people could accept and was valued, then I would do that and I would go write. Because, you know, when you've been working on your writing for 30 years, you know, sometimes when you say to people, oh, I'm just going to work on the novel, you know, you do get the, oh, yeah, okay, you know. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't help. It doesn't help to have that doubt reflected to you, because, again, it reinforces all those, as I spoke about before, those little girl fears, thinking that what I'm doing isn't important enough, it's not good enough, it's not right, I'm not doing the right thing or the good enough thing here. And I found that one of the decisions I had to make was to not see those self-doubts reflected back in people's faces and eyes. And so, you know, sometimes I would, you know, say, oh, you know, I'm just off to the gym to everyone, and I would go and sit in my car and I'd write, or I would leave a bit early for school pickup or drop off and I'd sit in the car and I would write. It's really about taking every moment. Kate Grenville used to speak about it as writing, like having a gun to your head as a mum. And, you know, it certainly feels like that. You know, you've got an hour and that's what you've got. So you better make the most of it, or else you're never going to get there. Same as in lockdown, you know, I'd get up early and I'd lock myself in the pantry and sit on the pantry floor, which, you know, helped because there was chocolate and bread. helpful, you know, because those times, as we all know, you know, they were difficult. And I think too, you know, the thing about how do you get this done, how do you get the book done, is as a mum, you know, you carry, you know, not all the time, but many times you carry the emotional load, and it takes up headspace. And the headspace and what you need to write a book isn't always about time. It's not about, oh, I've got 10 to 12 to write, I need to sit down and write. You know, the nuts and bolts of it happen in those times. And that's, you know, often we're in that beta brainwave, getting done, working mode. But in fact, what it really takes to write a novel, for me, is to have the ability to sink into a deeper, more relaxed state, you know, the more theta brainwave, so that you can imagine and problem solve and think. And if you've got different narrative plot points in a novel and you're trying to figure out how it all works, that problem solving comes into play as well. So how I got the book done was, yeah, finding those hours that were free, of course, because you need them to get it out, to write the words. But I also had to figure out very quickly what were the things that I could do to quickly get me in a state where I could think more deeply about the themes and the metaphors and the character development and so forth. And I know people talk about showers as being a really good way to do that, and walks. You know, a lot of people talk about walking and things like that. But for me, it was, there's this little, I live down on the Mornington Peninsula, and so there's lots of bush and, you know, to be completely honest, you know, I don't have an intimate relationship with nature per se. You know, it's not my first port of call to go out. I'd probably more likely go to a library or a bookshop, or that's just me. But there was this little spot near my little girl's kindergarten, and it had all these really beautiful trees, and it was very, very quiet. And so what I would do if I really needed to think a bit deeper and be a bit more relaxed, I would drive. I did a lot of riding in my car. And I would park there and I would get my laptop or my notebook out and I would utilize that feeling and that sense of quiet and calm to think deeper about the book.
They are such great, such practical strategies.
Can I ask the dumbest question? Because I know a couple of people that write in the car and I've always wondered about this. Do you sit in the driver's seat or do you sit in the passenger seat? Like where in the car do you sit?
Okay. All right, hear me out here. So I use different seats for different things.
Okay.
Right. I'm not crazy. Mm-hmm. Please don't think that I'm crazy. I can be borderline neurotic sometimes, but I find that different seats have different vibes. So, okay, so just hear me out. So if I want to feel more in control and like I'm driving the narrative and it's plot driven and I'm like, right, you know, okay, so there's a reveal here and I'm looking at, you know, those plot points, thinking about how the different characters' plot points interact, et cetera, et cetera, I sit in the driver's seat. And I make notes.
Metaphor too, right?
Obviously.
Embarrassing actually admitting this out loud. So but anyway, that's fine. I've started. I can't stop now. If I wanted to sit in the back and feel more, you know, give way to the themes and the metaphors, I'd sit in the back where my girls sit. And I'd kind of sit back into it and I'd have my notebook and I'd relax into it a little bit more. Windscreen's not in front of me. And so I don't feel kind of as seen by everyone, even though I've got a window next to me. It doesn't feel as out there behind the, you know, the steering wheel and so forth. And so I would sit in the back to do that more, like when I used to drive to this spot near the kindergarten with the trees, I would sit in the back and just give myself up to the process a bit more, surrender a bit more.
I'm so glad you asked that question, Catherine Collette. So glad we have that answer. You mentioned before, Megan, about your agent. So can you just fill us in now on this? You're writing the book, you've written the book, you've got Layla's story down. At what point do you say, okay, it's time, I'm going to get this out into the world, and how did you go about doing that?
Oh, that's a really good question. And it's actually something I was thinking about last night because my daughter was at swim training. And this is the best way I can think of to explain the exact moment that I sent it out. So my daughter is a butterfly swimmer and she is turning 11 soon. For anyone out there, I can't swim to save myself, so goodness knows where she's gotten it from, but she loves it. She loves swimming like I love writing. Mm-hmm. And over the years she has, and of course I've seen her develop all the building block skills to get to the butterfly. So the basics of breath and the dolphin kick and how to create the least resistance when you're using the arms. So they're all these little bits and pieces. And I've watched her struggle and learn and get each little bit and, you know, separately often. And just before I sent it out, I went to, it was her real first competition at MSAC, which is the Melbourne Sports and Aquatic Centre. And I saw her compete and I still feel sick thinking about her standing on the diving block because I find those things really difficult. And she dove in and she swam. And I still get a bit teary and goosebumpy, you know, thinking about it, but it was magic. It was just something clicked where all of the years of learning the bits and pieces of her skill, of her craft came together. No one knows why it was that moment. It came together and she swam and she won. And the look on her face when she came out, she surprised herself. And I could see even in that moment that she was thinking all of those little bits and pieces, it just worked. It all worked together. And for me, you know, I've been doing this a while and I do believe in the craft as a skill and learning it. I don't think you necessarily need to go to university to do it. I only did just because that was my path and it gave me permission to write, but you can learn those skills in many different ways. I believe it should be inclusive and available to everyone, which it should be. You do learn it whatever way you do that. And so you learn about setting and plot and nouns and verbs and the simple building blocks, but You know, you do learn about foreshadowing and reveals and metaphor and all of those things which build a novel. And looking back at my writing now, you know, probably the story about the policeman's one of them, you know, when I was looking at the twist and practicing that, each of my pieces of writing before that had been an exercise in craft. And I could see what I was doing. I was trying to personify the setting, or I was trying to show character development and, you know, why a character changed and how. And each bit of writing was an exercise in craft. Like when I watched my daughter swimming, it was an exercise in individual skills. She was doing a dolphin kick. She was breathing and so forth. And there was a moment when I, and I think I've posted about this before, but we were in lockdown and I took my girls to the drive-in for carols because I always go to carols by candlelight at the Maya Music Bowl on Christmas Eve, and we couldn't do that this year, which was really sad for me because my dad used to line up for us every year, and there was a double-edged sword in that because not only were we not able to go, but he was in a nursing home. And so I patched them up and put them in the back seat with our Christmas jumpers, sequins, and we watched the carols on the screen. And, you know, this is another example of getting the work done. They fell asleep on me and I knew that I would have a couple of hours that night to write. And so you just do what you have to do. And I slipped very carefully my laptop out with bodies resting on me, dribbling jam donut all over me and writing. And I wrote the final lines, which I won't say now, but I remember in that moment feeling as though it wasn't just an exercise in those bits and pieces of craft, that something, whatever it was, felt something close to magic, and that moment that I'd seen my daughter complete that 50 metres in butterfly and come out, I felt like that. And, you know, I'm not saying necessarily that, you know, it's the most brilliant piece of writing in the world, but in that moment, for me, compared to what I'd written in the past, relative to that, it was something close to magic.
That's the moment. That's the moment. So did you, before the carols ended, send it out to your preferred agent and say, right, do it. Let's get it out there into the world. Or was that somewhat more strategic?
No, of course not, because even though it felt something close to magic, I was still terrified on every level. And, you know, even though it felt something close to magic, once I woke up the next day, I went, oh, Megan, what are you doing? Like, you know, and the little girl comes up and she goes, oh, Megan, I don't think you should do this, you know. And so it took me a few weeks, actually, and I had kind of looked around at agents over that time when I was experiencing a lot of self-doubt and whether I was going to, and I sent it to Zeitgeist and I sent it to one other agency. And I was surprised and very grateful that I got a response from both of them. And as soon as I spoke to Zeitgeist and Bonython there, I think Alice was in that meeting as well, as soon as I spoke to them, you know what it was, and actually I'm just realising this now, is that I felt as though that little girl inside me could sit next to me in that meeting and she was okay. That's how I knew. Yeah, that's how I knew. I just realized that then. Yeah.
From that moment when you signed with Zeitgeist to the moment you got whatever it was, the phone call, the email, the text message to say, Megan Rogers, we want to publish your book.
Yes.
How long was that?
God, it always seems longer than it is, doesn't it? So Bonython was, like many agents are for people, my first reader. Nobody had read my book, no friends, no family, no one. And so he was my first reader and then so in many ways my first editor. So, you know, and he's a fantastic editor. He's very, very, very good at what he does. So we got it to the point where we were happy to send it out. And we made a list of publishers who we thought might fit the bill based upon what they're publishing at the moment and the publishers, you know, the type of voice that they like and so forth. And it was just before Christmas. It was actually about now.
Ooh.
It was about this time last year. In fact, it might be pretty close to the day that we sent it out to publishers. And, you know, I just remember I was standing at front of my local cafe, because that's, you know, of course, the other place where we all write is in our local cafe. And I was talking to him on the phone, and he pushed the button send whilst he was on the phone to me, and he goes, "All right, it's going to get real now." I'm like, "What? Yes, it's going to get very real." And boy, it got real, and it got, you know what? It didn't get real really quick. This is the thing. So essentially he sends it out to publishers, and they have a certain amount of time by which to get back with any interest. And so it was about, say, 4 weeks or a few weeks time. And that waiting period, talking about liminal moments, was excruciating, utterly excruciating. And people were saying to me, just, you know, go for a run. Side note, I'm not a runner. go do yoga, go do this, go do that. And I found it really hard to do anything that would distract me from.
It's also because every spare moment you normally put into, like, you're not used to doing these other things. Like, it's a double cruelty, I always think.
Such a double cruelty. Yeah, it is a real double cruelty. That's a great way to put it. And so it was excruciating. And And as everything happens, of course, people don't get back by the deadline. So I had, you know, I'm thinking, oh my goodness, you know, people, maybe no one will want it. I don't know. Like, I was going to be happy with one person getting back to me. And, you know, the whole reason I had an agent was because if somebody had said to me, "We'll publish your book and we'll give you $2, I would have said, "Yes, where do I sign?" So I was very, very, very lucky that we had 5 responses from different publishers, which I still to this day, I kept saying to Benath, and I said, it's my book. Are you sure? Like, it's not some other book that they've opened up and read. Is there a mistake somewhere here? And then it went into, so when there are a few offers and they're interested, then it goes into what's called an auction.
A heated auction, as they tell us in books and publishing.
It felt quite heated from my end, because I was just felt like I was literally on fire for those days. And I met with the publishers leading up, and they were all incredible. They were generous and insightful and beautiful and kind, and they believed in the book. And that to this day feels incredibly surreal, but it was my daughter's 10th birthday, and she had some friends over here, and I don't get good phone reception in the house, so I have to walk down the driveway to be able to talk properly. And, you know, we had 60 calls or whatever it was that day when it was getting to the final stages, and my daughter had her cake on the table, and she was wanting to cut her cake, and I kept saying, sorry, you just have to wait. You can't not take that call, right?
No, you can't.
Down the driveway, and I was like,
"She's going to have other birthdays, right?" Like,
at that time, I don't think she believed she was going to.
No, of course.
That's how she was living that moment. That was the most important birthday cake she was ever going to eat. And so I would talk on the phone, and then I would come back, and of course, just as I was lighting candles, the phone would ring, and she had friends around her, sitting around her as well. And I was like, just need to take that. And it got to the final stages, and, you know, I had met with Catherine, and I had known about Catherine and seen interviews with her and read her blog posts. And it got to the point where I had to choose. And, you know, I think I may have said this before, but I sat quietly as I think they were hitting the pinata around that time inside, and I could hear, like, you know what a pinata is like, right? It's just, it's mayhem. And I don't care how old people get, it's a fight. It's a fight for the last, you know, starburst. That's how it is. So I could hear all these things and chip bowls being knocked over and, you know, all these things. I was trying to have a quiet moment to decide one of the biggest decisions I probably make in my life. But I knew pretty quickly when I sat with myself that HarperCollins was the place for me, and that Catherine, you know, that she would be the publisher who for me would be best to take it out into the world. And so I called Benath and I said, I want to go with HarperCollins. And I walked back inside and I got to cut the cake and everything, and then a phone number popped up on my phone, and I went down the driveway and I'm thinking, please be Catherine, please be Catherine. And I said, hello. And I had this, hello, Megan, it's Catherine Milne. And we were crying and she was crying. And I was, it was one of the most emotional moments of my whole entire life. And I walked back in after I'd spoken to Catherine, and probably mascara, you know, my hair is like here, tracksuit pants. And the look on the faces of these 10-year-old girls when I walked in, they had the, I think your mum's crazy or something. And I had to, you know, my little girl said to me, Mummy, are you okay? Are you sad? And I had to say, no, these are really happy tears, girls. And, you know, then everyone kind of left and went to bed. And, you know, one of the things that really shook me and took me by surprise is how private the moment is. It's really, really, it's a bit like grief, actually. It's very grown up and it's very, very private, because it's a conversation you have and can only have with yourself. Because, you know, coming back to those moments when you choose writing and you make the choices, you're the only one who knows those. And you're the only one really who knows how much you really, really wanted it. Mm. Because often you don't express it right, just in case it doesn't happen. And I think I poured myself, you know, a glass of wine, and I remember the Christmas tree being up, and I sat down and I just sat quietly with myself, and I honestly couldn't believe it. I was in shock and awe, and I just sat quietly for a moment, quietly with, you know, that little girl who wanted it so bad, and we just sat together and we celebrated in a really quiet, private way.
Megan Rogers, I feel like we've gone pretty deep in our first two episodes, and we are going to go, no, it's brilliant. We are going to go deeper still, and we will catch up again next time.
Thank you.
You can find the show notes for today's episode on our website, thefirsttimepodcast.com. Get in touch with us via Instagram or Twitter at @thefirsttimepod, or you can leave us a message on the website. Thanks for listening. You've been listening to The First Time Podcast. We record this podcast virtually on the unceded lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation. We pay our respects to elders, past and present, and we extend that to our First Nations guests and listeners. Sound production by Phoebe 80, who we can employ because of the wonderful support of our patrons via Patreon. Thank you so much for making this podcast possible.